The theme that I've been working with is Heart Sutra. Heart Sutra is one of the pithiest and one of the most broadly studied and chanted texts in Buddhism. And it's called the Heart Sutra because it's the heart of everything. It goes to the heart of everything. But I like to think that it's called the Heart Sutra also because it comes from the heart. It's a way of understanding things that comes out of the heart. Since we have some new folks, let me sort of back up a little bit and create a little bit of context around this. And what I've been doing is going through one line at a time of the sutra. It's only one page long. And that doesn't seem like very much, but it's packed pretty tightly with some very interesting stuff, so it'll take a while to work our way through it. Usually, when one... In the Buddhist world, usually, I might phrase it that way, in the Buddhist world, there are cultural reasons for being interested in Buddhist practice. It's usually because it's like Christmas in the United States or something like that. You just sort of grow up with it, and it's what you do. Or if you're Jewish, you grow up with Hanukkah, and you don't really need to know anything about what it's about. It's just part of your life, and so that's the way it is. But in regards to Buddhism in the United States, sort of the question is a little different, because probably everybody is Christian in this room, maybe Jewish, probably not anything else. Well, atheist or big mishmash, but probably not Buddhist by origin. That would be pretty unusual. So the question is, why would anybody be interested in this who isn't born into this sort of situation? And maybe you're not interested in Buddhism. Maybe you're interested in meditation because you're interested in learning more about yourself or quieting your mind or finding some peace of mind. And there's not, I don't think in my own experience, a whole lot of difference between those two things. I mean, people tend to think of Buddhism as being like a religion, and so then there's this question of, do I have to give up my religion to join that religion? And if I join that religion, does that mean there's like people in authority and rules and so on and so forth? And in some parts of the world, that's probably true. But in this part of the world, i.e. Oregon, that's definitely not true. Whether it's Eastern or Western Oregon, there's none of that stuff going on, really. Well, maybe a little bit in Western Oregon, but certainly none of that going on in Eastern Oregon that I'm aware of. So I think really what people mostly are interested in is meditation and finding a way in to themselves to find some place which is calmer or more peaceful or happier or something like that. And actually, that's exactly what Buddhism is about. So there's not actually any difference between meditation and Buddhism from this point of view. Because from the point of view of being a religion, Buddhism is about actually finding your own nature, which is that everybody deep down inside is a Buddha. What's a Buddha? A Buddha is somebody that's awake rather than a robot walking around going through the paces of life. A Buddha is a person, male or female, it doesn't make any difference. A Buddha is a person who's wide awake to the truth of who they are and what's going on around them, which would sound like a more or less simple thing, but I think those of us who've been on the planet for more than about 10 years know that it's not a more or less simple thing to actually know what's going on or to really know what's going on inside of us, let alone what's going on outside of us. So these things are all wrapped up together. And the Heart Sutra is a way of looking at what's actually going on inside of us for the sole purpose of finding wisdom, which is just the flip side of a coin, the other side of which is peace of mind or joy or something like that. So that there's not really much difference between really understanding what's going on and being really peaceful and happy. When you get one, you get the other. They go together. Because the Buddhist view is that what makes us unhappy and drives us crazy is misunderstanding who we are and what's going to make us happy, which doesn't exactly seem logical. Maybe it even seems counterintuitive, that we would think we know what would make us happy. So I'm 67 years old, and I still haven't figured out what is it on the outside that would make me happy. I mean, I know some things that make me unhappy. You know, when I'm away from my wife for a long time, I tend to miss her, and that makes me unhappy. But those are sort of obvious things. You know, the deeper question of what makes us really happy is somewhat more complicated. And so the Heart Sutra is about that. So the way the sutra begins is with the Buddha and a bunch of his monks sitting around, sort of the way I'm sitting here, except they didn't have nice soft cushions. They sat on piles of leaves and rocks and things like that. As this 2,500 years ago in India, and they didn't have much. There were, as one of my professor friends likes to say, they were old-style hippies, and they just didn't have anything at all. And basically, India was a rich country, so you could get a free lunch and a free breakfast because there was enough food to go around. So if you're willing to only have a robe and a stick and a bowl and maybe some tweezers, you could go through your life without having to do anything except beg and sit under a tree and meditate. And so that's really what these people were. They were just old-style hippie vagabonds who wandered around and meditated. But one of them was the Buddha. And so the Buddha was sitting around with some of his students, and they were meditating. And there was sort of a question and answer that comes up in this context of their meditating, where one of the students asks another one, if I really wanted to understand how to develop wisdom, how to develop perfect understanding about things, how would I do that? And the other student answers that question. So one student asks the question, the other student answers the question. And that would seem very straightforward, but there's a statement in the sutra which is particularly interesting. And what that statement is that the student who does the answering and the student who does the questioning do so under the inspiration of the Buddha. Okay, it's like he's sort of behind the scenes pulling the strings, like sort of provoking one student to ask a question and then sort of provoking another student to answer it in a certain way. But he doesn't say anything. So I've always been interested in how is it that that's possible, that the Buddha is sort of pulling the strings to get this dialogue going, but he doesn't say anything. In fact, he's in a very deep state of meditation. He doesn't budge at all. And the answer to that question is really wrapped up in the issue of why would we all gather as a group to do meditation. So you could be coming here because you'd like to learn how to do meditation, and that's great. But for a lot of people, it's nice to come together as a group and meditate, to quiet your mind in the presence and company of other people who are doing the same thing. Because it feels a little different to be doing it with other people than to just be doing it by yourself. So the interesting question is, what is it in you that feels that it's different to sit with other folks rather than to sit by yourself? What is it in you that feels that? So in my life, I've had the opportunity to live in several Buddhist monasteries. And in Zen monasteries, everybody gets together, just like we are here, and nobody says anything, and they sit in rows facing the wall. And at a certain point, someone, and then they all get up, and they bow to each other, and they walk out. That's it. They start sometimes by reciting the Heart Sutra, by the way, but then they sit staring at the wall for 40 minutes or something like that, then they get up and leave, and that's their whole thing. So the question is, why do they do that together? Why is it different to do it together rather than to just, they all have their own little rooms, they could all sit in their own little rooms, you know, they wouldn't have to come together to do this. So I've always been intrigued by the answer to that question. And there are lots of possible answers to that question. So Kayla, my wife, whose presence is absent, spent about, I don't know, I think 9 or 10 or 11 months in a Zen monastery in California before I met her. She did that. Her former husband died, cancer. And she did a retreat to sort of sort herself out. And so she had a lot of interesting experiences there that she talked about. And one of the things that she said that was so interesting was there is this period of time called the Sesshin, where everybody gets together for about a week and they meditate for about 10 to 12 hours a day. And that's all they do in the whole community. And there's no talking during that entire period of time, except for the people who are maybe in the kitchen. And they're not talking when they're cooking. They're talking when they're saying, what do I put in next if they're stirring? So, you know, that kind of minimal but not chatty kind of talking. And she said it was quite extraordinary because you could be sitting for day after day after day staring at a wall, and it's a mixed community of men and women, and you fall in love with the person to your right who you're not saying a word to. And you'll absolutely despise the person to your left that you're not saying a word to. Because the person to the left every once in a while sniffs, and it drives you crazy. And the person to the right has this really sort of rhythmic breath. And so, you know, but you don't even know these people, right? And you don't even say a word to them, but then there's all this kind of stuff that's cooking around in the meditation hall, right? Because obviously that's not just happening for you, that's happening for everybody. So she talked about that. So how is that possible? Well, the answer is that you don't really fall in love with the person to your right, and you don't really despise the person to your left. What's really happening is it's all inside of you, and you're seeing it on the outside. Right? Mm-hmm. So one of the things that happens when people come together is an opportunity to see yourself sort of layered onto or projected onto other people. And you learn really interesting things about yourself because there's nothing going on over there, really. I mean, there's no conversation. You don't know this person. You don't even know this person's name. How do you fall in love with this person that you probably never even had your eyes meet each other? It's quite possible, too, you know. So these things happen. Well, it's yourself falling in love with yourself. And so that's pretty interesting, you know, that yourself can fall in love with yourself. Equally interesting that yourself can despise yourself, you know. Or maybe it's not interim. That may not be news to anybody that that's possible, you know. But, so there it is. So that's one of the things that comes out of our sitting together. But then the other thing that comes out of our sitting together is there's kind of what I might call kind of an extra energy that happens when you're meditating that isn't happening when you're just sort of distracted by the world. There's a kind of energetic vibrancy that goes on inside of yourself that you can feel. So when a bunch of people are together and they're all feeling that, it's amplified in my experience. I mean, we could talk about technically from the point of view of yoga, how does it get amplified, which I won't do tonight. But you can experience it getting amplified. And I'll give you an example of that. I have these photographs. Why don't you pass these around? They're all the same, but they're pictures that were taken a year ago at the Coliseum in Portland. And the Dalai Lama was speaking there. And I don't have enough to give everybody, but I just happen to have a bunch that, you know, pass them along. So the Dalai Lama was speaking there, and there were about 12,000 people. And when he came out to speak, I mean, there were folks who burst into tears, you know. And at the end of this event, there were people who were feeling well, this is really uplifting. And one of the things that the organizers did that was very intriguing was they tried to emulate something that's traditional in Tibetan culture, which is that when you greet somebody who is eminent, and sometimes eminent can mean a lot of different things, you don't want to greet them empty-handed. In the Asian world, kind of greeting people empty-handed is not considered very good-hearted. So you make an offering. And in the Tibetan world, for whatever reasons, I don't know what the tradition of this is, it would be a scarf, which is to say basically a piece of cloth. Because in a world that's poor, a piece of cloth is actually a precious item. Right? So the tradition in Tibet was when you greet somebody, you would greet them and you would offer them a cloth, a scarf. And among the Tibetan monks, the monks would take it and they bless it and hand it back to you. So it's like a gift exchange. And it's a very, very sweet, very nice way to meet people. So there are 12,000 people in the Portland Coliseum. And toward the end of the event, all these scarves get passed around. And the organizers say, well, you know, each one of you can't meet with His Holiness, and He can't meet with you. It would take forever for 12,000 people, right? But what we can do here is we can all stand up and we can all hand Him a scarf. Symbolically, He can take them all and hand them back. And so this photo that you're looking at was a little window of maybe 100 or 200 people from this group, which is why it's that window, who were holding up scarves. Now, Kay said it was quite extraordinary. She was looking down at the stage, looking at him when this happened, and she wasn't really thinking too much about it, what was happening around her, because she was kind of focused on him. And then she looked, and the whole stadium had turned white. Mm-hmm. So you saw that, right? The whole stadium had turned white, and there are all these people who are making this offering. And some people were very, very moved by it. And you can see some of the faces even in this photograph, which is not very detailed, but you can see some of the faces of people who are very moved by this. And there's this contagion then, if you will, to use that kind of language, of this collectivity coming together, doing something generous. And His Holiness symbolically doing something generous back to everybody. It was very, very moving. So when people come together, my point is when people come together to do something, there is something very extraordinary that can happen. So we're all ordinary people. He's not ordinary. There are 10 of us in this room. There were 12,000 people there. So everything is magnified a lot, but the basic principle is the same. So shortly I'll stop talking and we can chat a little bit about what I've had to say. And then we'll do a tea, not a tea, a formal tea, but we have some tea and some extremely sweet fig Newtons in the back. Or, no, they're not fig Newtons, they're blueberry Newtons in the back. And then we'll gather again, and I'll give you a little meditation instruction, and then we'll do a silent meditation. But the thing to think about, and maybe you'd like to ask me some questions about this while we have the time, is if we're all sitting here silently and breathing together and being focused inwardly on ourselves, does it feel different to us to be with a group of people doing the same thing? And so I kind of invite you to notice that or not notice that. I mean, if you get so relaxed that you fall asleep, you won't notice that, but that's all right. Being deeply relaxed is a good thing. I tend to be a little wound up too tightly these days. So if I fall asleep, you'll excuse me. If I fall asleep, I'll fall off my cushion, though, so I'll probably stay awake. Okie doke. I was going to talk about the Heart Sutra today, but there are a lot of new folks here, and I guess I sort of did in a kind of a roundabout way. I didn't actually pick the line of the text that I had planned on talking about. Whatever inspires me is what I talk about. So, I mean, is there anything interestingly strange in what I said? Anything worth talking about?
It seems to be me that that sort of amplification thing can be both good and bad. If you have something like this subject, the soccer riots.
Ah.
Like, just whatever emotion, whatever sort of emotional power there is can be really amplified in a group.
Yeah.
And that goes for both good and bad ones. Good things like meditation or prayer, but the bad ones and like violence. And
right.
Usually
when Buddhists get together to meditate, one of the things they try and do is establish the intention for what they're doing so that good things come out of the practice rather than questionable things. So we should remember to do that so that we don't get irritated with each other sitting here because somebody starts to snore or something, whatever. But you're right. I mean, it's the same process. I mean, going to a football game, over on the EOU campus, same process. A lot of people get together and they're focused on the same thing with a certain kind of emotion, and it does get amplified. It's very strong. Nobody thinks of it being very mystical, but actually I think it is, you know, from that point of view.
Is it possible that there is through the spirit of meditation, a touching the divine, and that is amplified through the experience of more people gathered doing it. And
you experience that from the Quaker background, wouldn't you?
Right.
So Buddhists don't talk about the divine too much. They don't. They don't really say a whole lot about what we will call God. If we start talking about God or the divine...
I'm not sure it is God. I wouldn't use that term.
Okay. But you like the word divine.
I do, because it's less controversial than God.
I started out by saying that everybody is a Buddha. And the thing is that most people just don't know that they're Buddhas, which is sort of the problem. I mean, if you knew you were a Buddha, that would... task done. I mean, if you knew it really deeply, like as in... you knew you were a Buddha in the same way you know you're breathing or something like that, that kind of deep quality of knowing. So Buddhas, traditionally, and there are more than one, because if everybody has a Buddha nature, is a Buddha inside, anybody who finds it is a Buddha, who knows they're a Buddha, which means there are lots of them, there's not just one, are considered holy. That's a term that often appears in the scriptures. Buddhas are holy. So that's a way of talking about what you're talking about. But that means that everybody is holy. Everybody has that holy quality inside of them. And I guess if 10 holies get together, pretty potent.
It becomes a holy moly.
A holy moly.
Holy
moly. Holy moly. Holy moly. I mean, I'm agreeing with you completely in what you're saying. I think I'm just trying to Buddhify the language in some way. Americans don't really like to talk about certain things. And God is certainly controversial when people do talk about it. The idea that God would be inside of you could get you into a lot of trouble in some parts of the world, certainly. But it's the foundation of Buddhist thought, because if you pick the word divine instead of the word God, or the word holy instead of the word God, and that's inside of you, that's what you are, then what? Well, that's it. That's everything. There isn't anything else, is there? So the Buddhist views, you can find that through meditating. I think that's what I was trying to get to. Mm-hmm. Is that through meditating, you can sort of open up and set aside the distractions that keep you from knowing what's really going on inside, what you really are. Not that this is easy. I'm not going to pretend it's easy. It's not. I don't walk around feeling holy, Mr. Buddha, anything like that. But it's there. I know it's there because I bump into it once in a while. And just frequently enough that I'm willing to spend a lot of time looking for it to get back there. And that's a lot of what for me, that's what meditation is about, in fact. So every morning I get up and I sit down for about 90 minutes to see if I can find myself again. Most of the time I just get lost. Sometimes I find myself. And then, my real self, you know, and that's pretty nice. If it happens a few times a month, that's motivation enough to keep doing it. That's pretty good. Makes sense to you, doesn't it? Yeah. Okay.
I'd be curious to know if one were to come from the Christian faith or any faith other than Buddhism at any point in their life and chose to start doing something with the Buddhist Tibetan meditation piece. I mean, is it contradictory to practice a Christian faith and still try to be mindful and practice meditation? Is that a conflict?
No. There are quite a lot of Christian monastics who've investigated Buddhist meditation practices and Hindu meditation practices also, and then they've employed them to enrich their own spiritual experience. So I used to live in San Francisco, which is sort of a hotbed, at least it was a hotbed anyway, of this kind of thing. And there were a number of Catholic monastic environments or centers or retreat houses that had investigated these kind of connections and would teach people to do Christian meditation, which was actually traditional in Christianity but sometimes got lost along the way. And so people would look at the basic technologies, which are just human inner technologies, and they'd harness those for their own spiritual inclination. So yeah, that's the long answer to your question. There is a long history of this. Well, I don't know how long the history is, but there is a history of this that goes back 30, 40, 50 years in this country anyway, of this sort of thing happening. Christian yogis, Christian meditators, people who come out of interfaith conferences where they share their experiences. There have been a number of these kinds of things where they share their experiences and they enrich each other's practices so they can bring those practices into their own tradition. Because a lot of them have to do with focusing the mind and not being distracted, learning how to not be distracted or how to deal with distractions when they come up efficiently. And so then it's a question of, are you being distracted from meditating on the Buddha or are you being distracted from meditating on Jesus? Same distraction. But who are you meditating on is sort of the question. And those things are different then, because Buddha and Jesus, I don't think, are the same. I think they're different. And this is not an evaluative statement. I just think they're different. That's personal. That's all. I mean, that's not a statement of absolute truth. That's just my point of view. I don't know any absolute truth.
Are there any examples of the reverse where Buddhism has incorporated traditions from?
Yeah. Well, historically, definitely. But for me to answer that question from the historical point of view would take us pretty far afield. And Buddhism in China incorporated a lot from indigenous Chinese religion. And what we call Zen is a result of that, the coming together of Buddhism and Taoism, which is an indigenous Chinese religion, with a little sprinkle of Confucianism in there also. And Zen is very much a product of the Chinese mind. There are traditions that are like that in Tibet and were in India, but there are things that are unique about Zen that reflect the influence of China. Other things that happened in India that were influences that came in out of Persia or Central Asia, I mean, if you're a scholar, you can track this sort of thing. But more recently, what's interesting is I know of cases, because I've spent a lot of time around Tibetans, I often talk about cases of things that have happened among Tibetans or something. The Dalai Lama said such and such a thing. This is another case where I'm going to say that. He's known to have had teachings with large numbers of monks where he say things like, you know, you're all sitting around here meditating, and that's really great, but there's a lot of need in this community for hospital work and so on and so forth. The Christians over here, they're really good at that. Why don't you pay attention to what they're doing and learn from them and do more of that yourself? Like this kind of thing, you know. It's like, so that's an example. And that's a very contemporary example. And there are quite a number of contemporary figures that he'd point to and saying, see what they're doing over there, or this teacher, you should pay attention to what he's saying in this regard. Also in regards to science, I mean, we don't probably think of science as being like a religious tradition, although actually I think it is, but apart from that, there have been many instances where he has said, you know, look, if there's something in the scriptures which science has disproved, then throw out what's in the scriptures. Because, you know, science is a way of, within limits, understanding things in a very definitive way. And sometimes the things that are in the scriptures are there because they're cultural or who knows how they entered into these scriptures. So if rationality or science is contrary to what you read in the scriptural tradition, go with rationality and science and forget about the scriptural tradition. But be careful, because science can't be applied to everything. So in regards to the areas where it can be applied, though, then it... And he always says logic, rationality trumps everything. So that's another example.
When you were just talking about Buddhism versus Christianity and how they've picked up some of those things with the finger wagging, would you say that, it just made me think about Buddhism versus Christianity, would you say that that's much more focus of internal, you know, yourself, and it's not really designed to be reaching out to doing...
That Buddhism is?
What's that?
That Buddhism is not?
Yes. Is that what you would say, or is that an overstatement?
Well, it's... I think it's often... historically been true, but I don't think it was always true, and I don't think it's natural to Buddhism that it would be that way. So we know, we scholars know from looking at history, that within a couple hundred years of the Buddha's life, Buddhism had spread pretty extensively throughout India, and there were cultural changes that occurred as a result of that. So one of the things that happened in India was people created animal hospitals to take care of animals that have been injured. So we think of ourselves in the 20th, 21st century as being ecologically concerned, and if there are pelicans on the coast who've been oiled, a lot of people will show, you know, like there's been an oil spill, a lot of people will show up and try and clean them up and take care of them and like that. And we have this sense that this concern for animals is perhaps modern and a little bit unique to our situation, but not so. So, you know, 200 BC in India, there are animal hospitals to take care of animals that have been hurt. And vegetarianism was growing in India, and it really took over India as a result of Buddhism, in this sense of not wanting to harm other beings. So those are cases where there was strong social action that came out of Buddhism. But there was also a strong kind of monastic inward turning, kind of stepping away from society tradition. Many cases in China where the monasteries would be the source of food during times of famine and caring for the community when things were really difficult. And that's one of the reasons the community supported monasteries, was there was that kind of equity that was recognized. When people were ill, the monastery might be the place where there were physicians that people wouldn't have access to otherwise, so they would go there, and that sort of thing. But it's, you know, not always the case. I'm not saying every monastery was like that, but there are cases, and then there are cases of monasteries where it was sort of like, leave us alone, we're meditating. It's a mixed bag, as you'd expect in any culture, in any religion, any tradition. tea time, tea and cookies. Yeah. Any more questions? And then we'll reconvene at, say, 7 o'clock, and I'll give some meditation instruction. We'll have some silent meditation together and see if we can enjoy each other's vibes.
Whatever they are.
Well, they're all good. I mean, it's all good, as Deb says.